I'm driving the poor people in the back crazy. They don't have a real camera tripod. And so they either have to go wide and just have the little guy walking back and forth up front, or it's very difficult to follow. But I'm just peripatetic. I walk. Standing, I'd end up falling asleep. So it's just sort of the way things are. People were asking really quickly. I just mentioned it in passing, but I'll go ahead and this is actually my 1977 New American Standard. This is I bought this probably 78, 79, something like that. It was a large print, and at the time, I'm not sure exactly what attracted me to it, but as I've gotten older, I can tell you exactly what has attracted me to it. I can actually read it. I look at all my favorite Bibles from back when I was younger, and they're not usable to me anymore, unless I want to stick glasses on my face and, you know, do this number and all of that. But I can still read this, and I like the 1977 because it still uses these and thous and the Psalter, which I like. But it was just a plain old bonded leather, black, you know. And so when I got in touch with Jeffrey Rice is a brother down, I think, in Tennessee, if I recall correctly. And he was a roofer and fell off a roof and injured himself really severely. And when he was trying to figure out what he could do to support his family, he had developed the skill of rolling copper and working with copper and doing roofing stuff. And he started working with leather and started doing some leather rebinding. And I saw a good friend of mine, Derek Melton, had this Bible that had the five solas on the spine. I thought, that's really cool. And then another friend, Kofi, posted a picture of this beautiful Bible. And so I got in touch with Jeffrey, and I sent him a Messiaen 28th edition Greek New Testament. And he did an incredible job on that Greek New Testament. The page edging he had done and things like that. It's just beautiful. So I had him on the dividing line. And he is now months backlogged. His business has become extremely profitable for supporting his family, and he does a fantastic job. So if you've got a Bible that you would like to have rebound, or sometimes just a brand new one that and just made buttery smooth. I mean, this is a preacher's Bible. You know, it hangs there in the hand, and it's just it is really, really great. Look up Post Tenebris Lux Bible Rebinding, and obviously he's literally taking orders for next Christmas right now. That's how popular his work has become. But it is. I've got seven of them now, and he did a Greek Septuagint for me, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. It's there. Each one of them is that thick, two volumes, and just astonishingly well done. So, and he rebound my 1550 Stephanus text. I have a 1550 Greek text, and it's from 1550. It was donated to us. The cover fell off, so I really couldn't use it anymore because I wanted. Because the main reason, and what's the real value? It's the text itself. And so I sent it to him, and he did this fantastic job in rebinding my 1550 Stephanus. So I can now carry it, and it's well protected, and it looks great. So, if you're looking for that, Post Tenebris Lux. There's other guys that do it too. I'm not trying to. I just happen to know Jeffrey well, and he's done a number of these for me. So, it does have a chip in it. So if you try to steal it, we will get you. And I don't care if you call yourself a Christian or not. You're going to the Huskow. That's just all there is to it. So, all right, let's, in the 45 minutes we have, let's tread on dangerous ground. It shouldn't be dangerous ground. It's sad that it is. But let's talk about something that is truly troubling the church. And maybe I'll just have to give some of the background on it before we can really get into it. But let's talk a little about it. When we talk about justice and equality, we talk about the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States today. We cannot, unfortunately, discuss any of these things without recognizing what some of the backgrounds to these things are. We know, for example, that the founders of the Black Lives Movement have been very clear in not only emphasizing their connection to Karl Marx and things like that, but they have made it very clear from the beginning that they are just as concerned about transgender people, queer people, as they like to use the term. I can remember a day when that was an insult, and now it's, you can't even keep track of things anymore. But they are very much into the destruction of the nuclear family, transgenderism, breaking down of those categories, just as Marx was. But they're doing it in a different way now. Rather than doing it solely on economic foundations, as Marx did, now it is dividing us along ethnicity, gender, and all these issues. What has happened since Marx is there has been a mutation, a retooling of his means of creating division. You are probably familiar with things like, or have heard discussion of, we're not going to, if I wanted to put you into a comatose state, it would not be difficult to do if we were to start putting names up on the board from the Frankfurt School and Derrida and Foucault and trying to talk about the nuances in their thought coming out of France and greater Europe and trying to sort of rehabilitate Marxism as it fell apart, as the Soviet Union fell apart, and to retool it, in essence. What we're dealing with today, and why this is so difficult for most of us Christians, especially if you've been raised within a Christian context, and hence maybe not had, I did not have in seminary, I did not have really anywhere, any reason to be exposed to a Michel Foucault or the writings of some of these individuals, unless you're reading the continental philosophers or something. They, together with postmodernism, have basically gotten together and had a really creepy baby. And that really creepy baby is what's causing all of our problems today. Okay? It is this strange mixture of postmodernism, which allegedly had died out. Well, it didn't. It just transmuted itself and borrowed stuff from other ways of thinking. But the idea of a denial of objective truth. There is no objective truth. That's why the postmodernists back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that's why, for example, and any of you who have read Schaeffer, you've heard these examples before, but the one that I love the best was an example of postmodern music. Now, I love music. I love all kinds of music. There are some Beethoven symphonies that are just astonishing in their beauty, are to me one of the greatest evidences of the fact that we're made in the image of God, that the human mind could produce that kind of rapturous beauty. And I don't know about you, but if someone started a movement to have Handel's Messiah canonized as the 28th book of the New Testament, I wouldn't fight it. I think that's probably a fairly, I might actually sign on for that one. I think that would be worthwhile, especially because it's all scripture anyway, so that's why you could get away with it. But the beauty of the Messiah, we've all experienced it. But at the same time, I'm not one of those snobs that goes, and that's the only kind. Some of you have probably chuckled at the fact that recently it has become known that I have become very good friends with a guy by the name of John Cooper. How many of you know who John Cooper is? Yeah, John Cooper, the lead singer of Skillet. In fact, Lord willing, we'll be spending the day together on Monday. He's off traveling right now. He just was on the Brian Kilmeade show yesterday. He's had a book came out that he had me read. He said, James, man, I really don't want to ask you to do this, but would you read it and make sure there's no heresy in it? Yeah. And he told me a couple days ago, and he says, now that it's out, man, I go on these interviews and I'm like, hey, if anyone has any problems with what I said, I said, well, I asked James about it and it's good. So we're we're good on it. So yeah, when you can go from Beethoven to Skillet, that covers a fairly wide range of things like that. But John will tell you, and I don't think John would mind if I told you this. Two Saturdays ago, I got an album from them that I had missed when I did my buy everything Skillet thing. I had missed one. And there was a song that I heard for the first time just a couple weeks ago that blew me away. And it's called Lucy. How many of you know Skillet's Lucy? Okay. And I'm sitting here going, there's something behind this. There is something behind this song. And so I read up online, and then I talked to John about it. We talk every day. And he told me, he said, yeah, it's about the regret that a couple felt. A young couple got in trouble, and they had an abortion. And they fell into deep depression. And a counselor told him, that's because you didn't have a procedure, you had a death. You need to have a funeral and name the child that died. And they named the child Lucy. Well, they didn't tell their label what that was about, because they knew they wouldn't have been allowed to actually publish it. But that was years ago, and so now the story's out, and I heard it. And John said to me, I think it's the best song I've ever written. And he's written a lot of songs. He says, it's not popular, but I think it's the best song I've written. Well, there's something beautiful about Lucy in a different way. There's something beautiful about Beethoven. But they both express... They both function in God's world according to certain rules. There are certain chords, there are certain progressions, music works in a certain way. Postmodern music, one of the postmodern composers, I love the use of that word composer, it's more like poser, but not composer, was to take a piano, empty a tray of silverware into the strings of the piano, and have a monkey bang on the keys. Can you imagine what that sounded like? What's the whole idea? No objective rules that tell you what is beautiful and what is not. The chord progressions and everything that makes a Beethoven symphony resonate and make us go, oh, the power of it, you've got to get rid of all that, because that implies an objective reality to the world that they're trying to destroy. That's what postmodernism is. That's the mindset behind it. And so that's why you get the breakdown of art, which had always been about how to communicate the reality, the objective reality of the world around us, now becomes just taking urine and throwing it at a canvas and calling it art and putting it in a museum, which is what has been going on for a long, long time. And so you take that postmodernism and then you suck it into a retooled cultural Marxism. And now you have what we're facing today. And so we have tribalism today. Tribalism. What do you mean by that? Well, obviously, the idea that we have today was, I think, expressed very clearly by a black woman member of Congress who about 2 years ago was speaking at a conference, and she said, we don't need any more brown faces that aren't speaking with brown voices. We don't need any more Muslims who do not speak as Muslims. We don't need any more queer people who will not speak as queer people. In other words, just be what you're told to be, what your tribe is. Don't break the mold. Don't be an individual. You're a part of a particular tribe. Now, here's the problem. Once you start doing that division, once you start saying, well, from the Christian worldview, we're all made in the image of God. And so no matter what your height, shape, nation, nationality, age, color, doesn't matter, you're made in the image of God, and therefore there are certain responsibilities and inalienable rights. Oh, where have we heard that before? Inalienable rights that come to you as one made in the image of God. And that means we have relationships with one another. And if we're consistent, then we're going to treat one another in a particular fashion. And so you go to the Bible, and the Bible says that justice is to be done for both the rich and the poor. And so you're not to take the bribe from the rich guy and let the rich guy get away with anything. And you're also, there's also the warning, you are not to favor the poor simply because he's poor. You're simply to do justice. There is an objective revelation. Now, do we always do that? No. Why? Because who are judges? They're human beings. And they are fallen human beings. And so they are subject to all sorts of things. And sometimes justice isn't done because a culture develops a particular perspective. So you can look at Europe, and Europe deeply influenced by the Christian perspective, the Christian way of viewing things, and yet was there ever a time when that perspective was consistently applied across the board? Of course not. Of course not. You had, for example, in the medieval period, you had this concept of knights and lords, and there were different standards applied to different people. And the whole royalty thing. Remember, the Old Testament warned, you want a king rather than me as God? You want a king rather than the just administration of my law? Here's what he's going to do to you. And he's going to tax you, and justice is going to be overthrown, and these are the bad things that are going to happen. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. And so there has never been a time when these objective realities are always applied perfectly. Remember last night? Cosmic justice, justice now in this world. We're supposed to do what God's law allows us to do in establishing justice in this world, recognizing that there is a limitation to how far that can go. I can't look into someone else's mind. I can't look into their mind and judge them on the basis of that. But at the same time, over and over and over again, especially the prophets, are talking about the fact that even amongst Israel, where you have this great light of revelation of what is supposed to be true, you have a constant denigration of it, a constant going against what God's law is said to do. So people look at that and say, therefore that doesn't work, therefore we need to get rid of it. No, that's not what Jesus did. That's not ever Jesus' teaching about the law. Well, see, it was just absolutely worthless and we just need to get rid of it. No, it reflected God's holy desires. It's going to be the standard upon which judgment is going to take place. Even in the Old Testament, remember, at the beginning in Leviticus, even there, we are told in Leviticus chapter 18 that the people of Israel were not to do according to the traditions and the actions of those who were in the land before them, because what they did was such an abomination, the land itself spewed them out. You think they're not going to be judged? You think the Amorite high priest sacrificing children to Moloch is not going to be judged because he didn't have a full copy of the scriptures? No, the scriptural teaching is he had what was necessary for him to know that he needed to thank God and glorify him as God, and yet he suppressed that truth and he engaged in idolatry and will be justly judged on the basis of the light that he had. That's the biblical message. But all of that today is being torn apart. You see, the biblical worldview connects us together. It connects us together. It reminds us that the person across the table from you, the person living next door to you, is made in the image of God. And we have to come up with ways of getting around that. So in Christian Europe, you created a tradition that made kings more godly and worth more in God's sight than serfs, or knights, or lords, or all the other things. Was that biblical? No. Was it a tradition that developed? Yes. And so in antebellum South, you had an entire theology developed around mankind and the black race, the Negro race. And you had people who knew their Bibles backwards and forwards, and yet they bought into the traditional idea that God had made a distinguishing between the races and gave certain privileges. And they would mistakenly use the arguments that, well, look at Israel being privileged over the Egyptians. See, I mean, look at what God does in delivering Israel and hardening Egypt, and Pharaoh's armies are drowned in the sea. And clearly there was a favoring of the Jewish people over these other people. And then you could expand that out to saying, and that's why we do the things that we do today. Missing the reality, of course, that even the favoring of the Jewish people, God himself said, was completely an act of grace. You alone have I chosen, but you weren't great. You didn't do anything to deserve any of this. That was one of the main things the Jews missed, too. But the point is, the biblical foundation provides for building a legal system that treats all men and women justly in the sight of the law. That doesn't turn us all into clones. It recognizes there is nothing in Scripture that says that the person who is thrifty and a good investor and hardworking should not benefit from everything that his hand touches. And in fact, it is considered to be a blessing from God. When you have a great painter who produces art that people want to see, there is nothing wrong with that person receiving riches for the great skill that they have that the rest of us don't have. And for anybody to say, well, there should be something wrong about that, means that what you're saying is God should not graciously give great gifts to certain people that he doesn't give to all people. That's what you're saying. That's what you're saying. And it used to be a given. We all understood and we all accepted that no matter how much I wanted to play NBA basketball, God didn't give me what I need to do that. Okay? That's just a reality. Getting mad at God or saying that you should cut a foot off of everybody else's body to make us equal on the basketball court doesn't make any sense. But that's where we are now. That's where we are now. Now we have this idea that true happiness will come when we are all equally miserable. That's the idea now. Everybody needs to have the same set of skills, the same set of abilities, same amount of money, live in the same kind of house, have the same travel possibilities. That is, if as long as you offer the pinch of incense and do what Caesar tells you to do. And that's going to make everybody happy. Does anyone really think that's going to make everyone happy? I mean, seriously. How do you get people to believe this? We know that there are certain people who have great musical talents. How is it that forcing all of us to be mediocre on one instrument is going to fulfill that person's giftedness and make them happy? It won't. It can't. It's absurd. And yet, this is the worldview that is now being proposed as being a great moral good. The unification of mankind as being made in the image of God then becomes the foundation for recognizing each individual as having responsibility before God and to other human beings. If you turn him into a mere animal, he has no responsibility before God. He's just a ugly bag of mostly water, fizzing chemicals. That's all he is. There can be no individuality that can be celebrated. I'm old enough to remember how we in the United States celebrate, and this was such a nationalistic thing. I'm going to tell you something. I didn't think nationalist was bad until 2 years ago. And every single time the Olympics went on, we were all nationalists, right? I mean, how many of you have sat there and you've followed the number of gold medals, the number of silver medals, the number of bronze medals, and you've been going, go USA, and now all of a sudden, you terrible, horrible person. When did that happen? It happened awful fast. But I remember when Bruce Jenner made us all proud in winning the decathlon. And we were following that, and we were celebrating. We thought that was great. And I wasn't standing around going, wish I could do that. I just don't think it's fair that he gets to do that, and I don't get to do that. I don't think he should be allowed to do that, because I can't do that. And anybody who does that, in my day, we recognize, was a sniveling little kid, an immature child. And the society that we are now promulgating is based upon immaturity. Being offended by everything. You look at me wrong and I'm angry. You're microaggressing me. My goodness, I struggle with this. I really struggle with this. Because I'm not that old. I know I look like it. But I'm not at 60 yet. I know I look like about 75. I understand that. But I'm getting there. And so I'm from a generation. I was taught that you needed to grow up and not be offended. There was this old saying we had that is now the most politically incorrect saying that I can imagine, and yet every little kid my age knew it. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That is now illegal. It is, isn't it? Words will never hurt me? Try that in the court of law now. You have transgressed against my dignity by saying I'm short. Well, you're 5'2". You're short. What do you want? Oh, no, you can't do that. You can't do it anymore. Institutionalized immaturity will be the end of this society, folks, because there are going to be other societies that go, let's not do that. We'll end up taking them over. It's institutionalized immaturity. And when I grew up, I don't know how my parents did it, but they told me, when you're 18, you better be ready to take care of yourself. It never crossed my mind that my parents were responsible for putting me through college. I was. And so I never got a B in high school. Got a full-ride scholarship. That's how you do it. It just never crossed my mind that my parents would even have the money to do it. And when I was 18, hey, at 16, I found the woman I wanted to marry. She didn't know it at that time. Took me a good 2 years to get her attention, but I got her. I was 19, she was 18 when we got married, and we didn't have to get married. And older folks are like, yeah. Anybody else as young as we were when you got married? There's one. Okay, dear, there's only one other person in the entire room as young as you and I were when they got married. That wasn't all that unusual. I knew what I wanted. Was ready to work. And now, my goodness, we've got people living in their parents' bedrooms and parents' basements until they're 35. They are the best snipers online in the world, but they don't really have much in the world's wisdom to show for it. And we're laughing because you all know of someone exactly like that. It's amazing. It's institutionalized immaturity. We don't grow up anymore. What's the average age of marriage now for a man? 29. 29, 27 for a woman. Wow. Most people getting married today will never ever see their great-grandchildren and will be on death's door if they see their grandchildren. If their children have children at all. By the way, do you have any idea how the American birth rate has crashed this year? boom, just crashed. I'm not going to bring a child into this COVID world. Wow. Amazing. So this worldview has now created what is to me the most destructive and yet inane system of thought ever, and it is the absolute committed worldview of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. It's called intersectionality. Intersectionality. What is intersectionality? Well, if you had asked me that 2 years ago, I would have gone, let me call my daughter. Because my daughter knew. Some of you know my daughter has a webcast called Sheologians, which was a joke, by the way. Don't ask her to explain it. She's tired of explaining it. But it stuck, and so she's stuck with it. And she has a very popular webcast. They've been taking on feminism for a long time, and so she was aware of these cultural trends long before I was. But intersectionality is where you take the worldview, and this is, so remember I told you that postmodernism and neo-Marxism had a baby. Well, that baby involves the idea that the narrative that drives the world, Marx said the narrative was the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, the workers and the people who own property. So he did it all on an economic level. Once you throw postmodernism in and the development of neo-Marxism over time, now what you've got is the oppressors and the oppressed. The oppressors and the oppressed. And there is nothing you can do about which group you're in, because it has nothing to do with what anything you've ever done. It actually doesn't have anything to do with what your ancestors did either, even though sometimes it sounds that way. You are in the group, and you are guilty of the group, so you're either an oppressor, even though if you've never oppressed anyone in your life, even if you were raised to treat everyone equally and view everyone as being made in the image of God and the whole nine yards, none of that matters. And in fact, if you dare mention it, let me tell you, let me give you a witness, you will get in deep trouble. Because I dared give my own personal history on this once, and oh, wow, you will be ravaged. But you have the oppressors and you have the oppressed. And the oppressed categories can be expanded even if those categories didn't exist more than 10 years ago. So if you're transgender, you are oppressed. But there was no such thing as transgenderism in its modern expression 10 years ago. There are transsexuals, but they had not developed this amazing theory of human existence. It really did not become a thing until about 2013, 2014. And that's when it became, you know, just as cutting, anorexia, all these things, that these crazes, that's, and it could never have ever existed, except for this. The number of transgendered people, as they call themselves, who now regret what they did, is legion. You're not allowed to talk about them. It's legion, and they'll all tell you the same thing. They found people online that when they started opening up about the confusions that they had, and guess what? I know no one else experienced this, but some people do. Being a teenager can be a confusing time. And some people get stuck in it. Being a teenager can be a confusing time for both men and women. And you go online and you start telling people about it, and you know what they say? You're transgender. I'm what? Had no idea. But they're coached. They're absolutely coached that when they go into at every single Ivy League school in the United States, any student can walk into the medical center in any Ivy League school and without any doctor's prescription say, I've always felt this way, and receive testosterone injections if you're a female. Which, by the way, will destroy you. Will destroy your body, will destroy your ability to have children in the future. When we mess with biology that way, we create death. And the stories are astonishing. Astonishing of what people are willing to do. But the point is, that group, that those transgender, they're oppressed. Even though they didn't exist as they are today in the year 2000, but they're oppressed. And so every minority group is oppressed. And the fact of the matter is, you can look back, and as long as you can find any mistreatment of any minority group, if it fits the narrative, then you can say, there's your oppression. And the problem, one of the problems here is, we take the American experience and we export it every place else, even to places where it creates absolute havoc. We have exported this through the church into South Africa. You want an explosive situation? Talk about South Africa. Apartheid, what has gone on down there, what's going on right now? Oh my goodness. But it's not just racial, because anywhere you go, I hate to tell you this, but anywhere you go in the world, there have been racial tensions. And the people perpetuating them and receiving them have been of every race on the planet. There isn't anybody who's guiltless when it comes to this. Right now, if you go to almost any university, you'll be told there's only one group that does it. Did you see AOC? See AOC 2 days ago? AOC saying, she had some, should have seen this dude that was testifying before Congress. It was really funny. He was dressed like that guy in Starsky and Hutch. Who was the black guy, black friend of Huggy Bear? Thank you. He was dressed like Huggy Bear was testifying before Congress. Okay, and I don't know who the dude was, but what AOC said was she was talking about the production of CO2 and greenhouse emissions, and she was saying, so isn't it true then that the vast majority of people who are producing the damaging environmental CO2 gases are white? And he said, all studies show that to be true. There you go. It's not just that. There is an obvious problem with that. What is the greatest carbon-emitting nation in the world? And it's not us. China. Oh, they're white now. They don't think they're white. And if you would like to have clear, open, KKK-level anti-black racism, you know where you go? China. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. China is deeply racist. And it's not just anti-black racism. It's anti-white racism, too. And you know why it is? Because it's we Chinese are the greatest. It's not just we don't like this particular group. It's we are superior to everybody else. Those are the people who get scary. Remember the Aryans, Nazi Germany? Yeah, it really gets bad when you think your group is the best group. Here's the problem. Once you divide everybody into oppressors and oppression, and then you start adding in as many categories as you want. So if you are a ethnic minority, that's one group. But if you're a gay ethnic minority, bonus points. That's exactly right. And if you become a transgendered ethnic minority who identifies as a female, you may be the next president of the United States, right there. I mean, because that's the jackpot. The point is, you just keep dividing and dividing and dividing. You want an example of this? How this works? Anyone remember Martina Navratilova? She was a good tennis player. I was always voting for Chrissy Evert, personally. But Martina was a really good tennis player. And she was one of the first ones to come out as a lesbian. And so Christians were like, this is terrible. And so she was a celebrity and, you know, on the cutting edge and everything else until she made a mistake. Because this LGBTQ thing doesn't hold together. Have you noticed that? That's one of the hopes that I have, is that it doesn't hold together. And I've never understood why it's put together. Think about it. The B, you almost never hear anything about that. Because it doesn't really go with the L and the G. Because it assumes categories that the L and the G violate. But then you throw the T in, and now you've got civil war. You want to see people going at each other? Look what happened to Martina Navratilova. Because think about it. If transgenderism is true, there aren't any lesbians and there aren't any gays. Because lesbianism and homosexuality assume a gender binary, which transgenderism says doesn't exist. So Martina made a statement a couple years ago, and then she absolutely ended her celebrityhood by refusing to back down on it. Unlike certain NFL football players that we could name, who have backed down on statements they've made, sadly. She said that it is absolutely wrong for biological males to compete against biological females in professional sports. You know why she said that? Because she's right. I'm sure there's some good tennis players in this room. I understand that there's one back against the wall, possibly. But the fact of the matter is, and everybody knows this, the top 500 men, the top 500 professional men could wipe the floor with the top three women. They could. Put a radar gun on their serves. Put a radar gun on their serves. And other than maybe that one lady, there's going to be a 15 to 20% difference. Why? Because men are stronger than women. And a good tennis player has got a wingspan like I don't know what. These 6'3" dudes, Dochevek or whatever his name is. He's, you know, Pete Sampras, remember? I mean, that racket head is flying through that ball when it fires it across the net. Women don't have that bone structure. They don't have that muscle structure. They don't have the connective tissue. And so, God bless the WNBA, but man, that's boring to watch. I remember when my kids were in Christian school and my son played basketball, and we had to watch the girls' games before the boys played. And it was sort of like, oh, I love how you look today. Thank you very much. Holding hands and wee. And it's just sort of like, oh, I'm sorry you missed. Oh, we'll do better next time, you know. It's true. It's true. I watched it. It was fun. So the point is, if you can find a female that can actually dunk it, that's unusual. But Spud Webb could dunk it. Does anyone remember Spud Webb? Oh, yeah. There's a difference between men and women. And Martina saw it, and she knew she could never have defeated Jimmy Connors or any of the people that were playing at her. She knew it. And so she knew it's not fair. It's the end of women's sports. It's over with. She wouldn't back down. She was attacked for when she first said it. She went and read a bunch of studies. She said, no, look, the reality is, I don't care what you do in dropping testosterone levels. I don't care what you do. If a person goes through puberty as a male with that testosterone going, your bone structure, your connective tissue, and your muscle mass, you're always going to have it. It'll get bigger or smaller, but you're going to have it. You're going to have the advantage. You watch a big league pitcher. We have a, in our church, we have a big league pitcher. I mean, he just retired, but and he was in Japan, but they won their World Series. I mean, this guy can throw a fastball like you wouldn't believe. And the fact is, when you watch a man throw a ball and then you watch a woman throw a ball, it's not the same motion because they're not made the same way. And guess what? He would have a heck of a time having a baby. Because that's not why God designed his body the way he designed his body. And so the reality is, she was right. But oh, has she been ravaged? She has been ravaged. You're not allowed to believe that. And so this intersectionality, what it's functionally doing is dividing us and dividing us and dividing us and dividing us, and your tribe keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it's just you. And you gain your authority by finding how many ways you can be oppressed. I am oppressed this way, and I am oppressed that way. That is a stinking way to live life. The Bible warns of it. All you got to do is read the book of Proverbs. And if you are constantly walking around, when I was a kid, you knew the kids, we called it having a chip on your shoulder. Remember that? I had a chip on my shoulder. I just dare you to offend me. You go ahead and just look at me in a certain way, and I'm gonna tell the teacher. I've told the story a bunch of times. I remember to this day, the day I started to grow up. I was riding my bike. I remember exactly where I was. It's 301 St. Mark's Road, Charmantown, Pennsylvania. And I remember what the bike was. It had a purple banana seat. That's how long ago this was. Oh, a purple banana seat. Yeah, all right. Probably had shiny, flecky stuff in it too, but this was a long time ago, late 60s. And a friend of mine insulted me. Said, you know, how kids will do the thing. And I stopped my bike, and I was going to go in the house, and I was going to tell Mom. Because that's what you do, right? You tell Mom. Or the Human Rights Council in Canada. That's how it's done now. Right? I was going to tell Mom. And then all of a sudden it hit me. I'd rather just keep playing. But going and telling Mom isn't really going to do anything, and I'm not hurt, so why don't we just keep playing and I don't worry about it. Wow. And you go, well, yeah, we all get that, do we? Does our society get it anymore? And once you start institutionalizing the idea that the way for you to get ahead is to put everyone down beneath you because you are the most oppressed. That's intersectionality. That's what we're dealing with. And believe you me, I doubt Joe Biden understands it. I'll be honest with you. No, I'm not. Look, the man's non-compos mentis, he's not there. And I can guarantee you, 2 years ago, he didn't know what intersectionality was. And I don't know that he knows what it is now. Kamala Harris knows. Kamala Harris knows. And what scares me is 2 days ago, Joe Biden joked about if he and Kamala Harris disagreed, he would, how does he put it? He would develop a disease and have to resign. Really? Yeah. And here's a man. Well, but she's sitting on the stage when he said it. She's sitting on the stage when he said it. And I'm sure she's sitting there going, oh, Joe, stop. Don't say it. But we all know. We all know what's going to happen. I've been calling this for a long time. The point is this. She is going to have a huge role in what's coming. And she believes all this stuff. And when people believe that this is moral, and this is good, and this is right, they can be zealous proponents of it, and they will put it in law. And you and I are sitting here, but they can't. The Constitution says, once you buy the idea that it's just a living document, which has been bought for decades, what the Constitution says and what it meant means no more than what this says and meant in liberal Christianity, which redefines everything anyways. Words can only go so far. You have to have the worldview that honors the meaning of words. There's the issue. So here's the question. What happens when intersectionality enters the Christian church? Because it's one thing for you and I to sit here and go, yeah, it's really stupid. For example, in Australia, you have something called rugby. Anybody ever seen rugby? Most of us here in the United States were like, meh. But when you travel down there, man, it's like a religion. And you have transgendered female rugby players. And you see this team run out of girl rugby players. And here's this dude that's 235 pounds playing rugby with girls that are 135 pounds. That's dangerous. That's absolutely dangerous to all the rest of them. We all look at that. We look at this McKinnon guy that won a UCI gold medal in cycling. A guy competing against girls. And we look at these track stars, these dudes that win by 10 seconds over the girls and set new state records. And we're all like, right, why are the girls even trying? I mean, why do they even take the start line? They know it's going to happen. They're just